will support some armed Arab Sunni groups, which the U.S. recognizes are to be the most effective to defy ISIS, which gets most of their support from the Arab Sunni community, and work with the Kurdish fighters, which are the by far the most effective fighters so far against ISIS. I mean, one reason ISIS has been able to take over large swaths of northern Syria and Iraq is that the troops of the government they're fighting aren't very motivated because the governments in Baghdad and Damascus are corrupt and not very popular. So the idea is, let's get this force of people who do have of popular support. They might have a better chance of making a difference. So there is some strategic logic to it, I guess. But frankly, I'm a little skeptical because Syria is such a mess, so factionalized, so divided. There's so many unknowns, and frankly, the more the United States has militarized the region, the more we've gotten involved. It tends to make things worse and worse and worse.
That's what we've seen in the past. Stephen, we're out of time here. Thank you so much for joining us today. It has always been a pleasure to speak with you. We've been speaking, of course, with Stephen Tunis. He's a professor of politics in the Middle East, with emphasis in the Middle East in the University of San Francisco. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, November 9th in 2015. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks for that, Kate. Captain Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
President Obama visits a federal prison. There's a call to federal prosecutors to lessen the use of mandatory minimums. There's bipartisan congressional support for reform. Tune in to Prison Pipeline to hear national leader Van Jones, who believes now is the time to end the mass incarceration industry in America. That's Prison Pipeline, November 9th at 6:30 p.m.
And the first one now will later be last, for the times, they are a-changin'.
KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. As pressure keeps building to turn the Pacific Northwest into a major petrochemical export hub, resistance to these projects grows as well. This morning we talk again with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about the current status of proposed oil train terminals in Vancouver, Washington, and LNG terminals along the Oregon coast. He'll give us an update as well on efforts across the region to stop these facilities from becoming the new reality for the Northwest. Dan, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's great to be back. Thanks, Barbara.
Well, I understand you just came back from vacation, so I thought I'd fill you in on what's been happening while you were enjoying yourself in the North Cascades.
That sounds great.
So I got a couple emails last week. One is from Stand Up to Oil, Communities Fueling Change, and it's urging the recipients to tell the Army Corps of Engineers to deny Tesoro Savage's dangerous oil terminal proposal. That's we've been talking about a lot, the one in Vancouver, Washington, across the river. The other one is from the Sierra Club, and it is letting us know that not only is Shell going to be using the Port of Seattle to service its mega ships and equipment to drill in the Arctic, but they're also going to be using Portland as well, and there's a rig that's scheduled to come to Portland soon. So that's what happened while you're gone. So, but before we get into like what's going on right now, I wanted to pick up from where we left off the last time you were on the show, which was like back in May. It was the day before you were going to be rallying in Salem to urge Governor Brown to stop the LNG terminals, or to actually take a stand about LNG in Oregon. So I wondered what happened.
Well, I think, you know, what was remarkable about that day and was the enormous turnout from all these different sectors of Oregon, from all these different geographic regions and different perspectives. I was really inspired. We had over 600 people, some estimated much more than that. It was actually hard to count because there were so many people sort of flooding the Capitol steps. And the speakers were very powerful. People, obviously, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., but even equally as powerfully, Jody McCaffrey, who we just heard from on the radio.
Down in Coos Bay.
Down in Coos Bay, came up and spoke alongside Cheryl Johnson, who's been a longtime activist in the estuary and the Columbia River. And Kathy Sampson Cruz with the Umatilla, Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, spoke on behalf of herself as someone who is very concerned about how these projects impact the river as a whole. And it was all of these things put together sort of made for a pretty compelling case as to why Governor Brown should say no to LNG. What we know now is that the governor is not in the same position that Governor Kitzhaber was.
Meaning what?
meaning what? Governor Kitzhaber was in absolutely the wrong place on LNG. Governor Kitzhaber was a vocal proponent of the Jordan Cove LNG project in Southern Oregon and the Pacific Connector gas pipeline, which, to remind your listeners, is a huge pipeline, 230 miles in length, that would cross hundreds of families' land, hundreds of streams and rivers, doing an enormous amount of damage in addition to the actual LNG export facility. And Governor Kitzhaber thought that was a good idea.
And where would that pipeline start?
It starts down in Malin near Klamath Falls. And so it would...
Why there?
That's where the Ruby pipeline would deliver gas from fracking fields in North America and bring that gas all the way across South Central Oregon to Malin. So this whole scheme is what we were there to talk about. But it was interesting to see the different perspectives that people had. Some were very focused on the property rights issues that are impacted by liquefied natural gas development. So these folks who live along the pipelines, whether it's in Southern Oregon along the Pacific Connector or Northern Oregon in places like Vernonia, where their water sources would be impacted by proposed pipelines.
And that pipeline that would go through Vernonia on the way to Oregon LNG, which
that's
is in
right.
Oregon, that also would cross the Mount Hood National Forest, as I understand.
It would not.
Oh, that's change plans.
That's the change. Yeah, that was option one, which we successfully defeated. We stopped the Bradwood LNG project and its connected Palomar pipeline with the help of great partners like Sierra Club, BARC, hundreds and hundreds of landowners who came together. We stopped an LNG terminal. And essentially what we're asking Governor Brown to do is to follow that same path, the path that led the state of Oregon to reject Bradwood LNG. The case is even more compelling for Jordan Cove and Oregon LNG. And I think it's telling that we had our really largest rally to date about LNG alone on a Tuesday midweek, kind of mid-morning, and hundreds of people came in, not just from the Portland metro area, which is kind of what you'd expect because it's so much closer. People came from all over the state. People came from Pendleton and Klamath Falls, up from Northern California, and really all over the region to make a statement. And of course, in Southwest Washington and Northwest Oregon, where the Oregon LNG project proposes a very direct impact to communities there as well.
Actually, I know some people from the Astoria area who came out.
That's right. And I know we have some folks listening out there who are, you know, long in the fight. They have been battling LNG on the Columbia River for 10 years. And we are very, very inspired and proud to work with all the folks in Astoria who have just stood their ground. And they're doing the same in Coos Bay. It's a more tense fight right now in Coos Bay because that project is trying to gain a license from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they may do so within the next year. And that is going to be a big point for the state of Oregon to make its own decision and decide, you know, we as people are going to demand the right one. We as people are going to demand that Governor Brown say no to LNG.
Yeah, I'm just thinking kind of this irony of few years ago, I was starting a project about tar sands, and I was focusing a lot on the Heavy Haul Corridor and talking with Stephen Hawley, who's a writer based in Hood River. And he was suggesting at the time that I expand my project and talk about the exciting model of stopping the LNG terminal in well, outside of Astoria, the one that was stopped, and that he thought that would be a great role model for what was still unfolding in Idaho and Montana as far as stopping the heavy haul. So that was stopped, but what gave it a rebirth?
Yeah, I mean, what gave it a rebirth is that it was one of three projects. And so what you saw was the natural gas industry sort of take a shotgun blast and point it at the West Coast. There was initially, you know, five proposals in Oregon, more on the West Coast, and what remained now are just two. What gave it a rebirth was very low gas prices prompted by totally unsustainable fracking and devastating gas drilling going on all over the Mountain West and in Canada, and much higher energy prices overseas with potential Asian trading partners. And so that in Japan and in South Korea, they pay much, much higher prices for gas. And so the gas industry said, well, we've got gas cheaply here. It's more expensive over there. And so these projects, which are $6 billion or more to construct, became viable to their investors. We think they're becoming increasingly not viable because people are standing their ground. They expected that after 10 years of a long fight that people would just go away. That hasn't happened. You know, over 80% of the landowners along the pipeline in Southern Oregon have officially refused to work with the pipeline company. That is absolutely remarkable. Two-thirds of the people in Clatsop County voted against LNG when they were given an opportunity in 2008.
And actually reversed their county commissioner's decision.
That's right. That's right. In a previous county commission that was voting in favor of LNG. Now they have a county commission, or at least in the recent past, they had a county commission that voted unanimously to reject the Oregon LNG project.
Didn't they actually recall that county commission that had voted in favor of it?
There was a recall effort, but ultimately what ended up really changing it was just people voted in commissioners who they felt represented them. And those commissioners looked at the same set of standards the previous commission had and came to a conclusion that was ultimately upheld by state courts. The Land Use Board of Appeals recently issued a very emphatic decision on Oregon LNG saying, no, this is a valid decision. What these commissioners decided was reasonable, that an LNG pipeline, natural gas pipeline feeding an LNG terminal could have a negative impact on landowners. You know, no duh is sort of the conclusion we reached, but it took a court case to make that clear.
So with that court case in place, how can Oregon LNG continue on with their proposal for the Warrington project?
Yeah, and continue on they are. They continue to push forward. What's missing is basically a decision from the state of Oregon to uphold what Clatsop County has done. That decision has been stayed multiple times. So it's sort of been pushed out, and it's been pushed out again into the fall. What it's also missing is kind of a decision from Oregon LNG's investors that this is an endless path of defeat. And we're convinced of that. And I think, you know, they've signaled that they're growing wary of this project themselves. And so ultimately what we need is a very clear signal from the state of Oregon that this project will not and cannot proceed. Clatsop County has done its part. And what we need is for the state of Oregon to stand up and back up Clatsop County. And the way that does that sort of in the law is they say under the Coastal Zone Management Act, this project is now denied. And what they've done so far is say, well, it's neither denied nor approved, and we'll just delay the decision for months into the future, which is really frustrating. Because what that does is it forces other agencies, like the city of Warrington, is now going to have to go through a whole permitting process for Oregon LNG. And this is a process that Oregon LNG doesn't even agree is valid. You know, and they're going to force the city to go through and say whether this LNG terminal meets all the land use code. And in the end, if the city says no, Oregon LNG is going to throw up its hands and say, well, we think there's a federal override to all of this. I mean, the solution here is for the people of Oregon to persuade our state leaders that, you know, we say no, that the state of Oregon can say no. And that's what we did with Bradwood. That's the recipe. It seems kind of far away from us now, but we, in the very recent past, we got the state of Oregon to not only deny key permits for a huge LNG terminal, but to sue the federal government when they had approved it. Those are both steps that we think Governor Brown can and should take.
Yeah, right after you were on my show last time, I received a lengthy email from a listener who also does, I guess, a commentary on KBOO once a week. And he used quotes from you on the show and then from Chris's news show before that, and was really putting down the notion that we, thinking that it's naive to think that we should go to the state and want the state to solve our problems when they should all happen regionally. So I want to just kind of get your take on why is it important that we get the state to take a stand and not just rely on regional, local, grassroots activity?
It's all important. I'll be clear. I mean, this is one path, and there are many others. And I fully recognize that there are people out there all over Oregon and Washington and the whole region who are coming up with their own solutions to how to try to stop these crazy proposals. And it's all of them. You know, it's the oil, it's the gas, it's the coal. The reason why we think that this is an important path is because this is a clear cut sort of, if they don't check these boxes legally, they can't build the project. That doesn't mean if they do check the boxes that we acquiesce and say that they should move forward. You know, but these are very important decisions that we think we can influence. We think we can get to the right decision. And frankly, we think our case is really compelling. We're right on the policy. We're right on the impacts to Oregon families. We know that these are bad projects. We've demonstrated that over and over. And it's a fight we can and should win. And that's, you know, and I think we've demonstrated, you know, the ability as a both a grassroots and kind of, I don't know what else to say, sort of policy movement to say, okay, you know, we don't have to become this huge fossil fuel corridor. Portland stood up in a very grassroots way and said, no, we don't want to be a propane hub. You know, the people of the Columbia River stood up and said, no, we're not going to let the Bradwood LNG project come in. The people of all over Oregon and Washington stood up to the Boardman coal proposal, this idea that they would ship coal down the Columbia River, barge it down to Port Westward, down near Klaskanai, and then ship it overseas. They persuaded the Department of State Lands, a regulatory agency, to deny a key permit. This is one path to victory that helps us at least build the momentum for the broader sort of changes that are needed that I think your listener was probably talking about.
Well, I was thinking the kind of interesting irony, Boardman is also the home of the only coal-fired plant in Oregon, and that's slated to shut down in the next couple of years.
2020, I think.
Right. So, and it was one of the first coal-fired power plants to be shut down prematurely. So it's interesting that Boardman, where it's famous for, we've stopped coal, it was being proposed to be the entry point for coal to enter into the Northwest and then be exported so it could pollute some other part of the world, which of course would wind up polluting the rest of the world as well.
Yeah, and you know that points again to the fact that there's this very open, ongoing struggle on the Columbia River, because even in the wake of Boardman being denied that project, that key permit, that same company is still pushing forward aggressively to build an even larger facility in Longview, Washington. Amber Energy wants to build a 44 million ton per year coal export facility, huge open piles of coal right next to Longview neighborhoods, eight full, eight empty trains a day rolling through, you know, basically the industrial area of Longview, which blocks essentially every major intersection near the Longview-Oregon Bridge, the Lewis and Clark Bridge. It would have a huge impact on the community. And the solution to that has been, so far, the state of Washington. The Washington legislature just approved $85 million to build a new overpass, essentially for those coal trains, to get them in and out of Longview. So the public is going to end up subsidizing, if it were to go forward, this mega terminal for coal exports. And while that decision by the legislature in Washington was very, very disappointing, it doesn't signal that project is moving forward. It just reinforces the need for us to make a clear statement and get Governor Inslee and the other decision makers in Washington to listen to us and to do the right thing.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about the push to make the Pacific Northwest the gigantic hub for fossil fuel exports. And my guest is Dan Sears, who is Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper. Well, let's get back to Governor Brown, because we this is a bit of a cliffhanger. You've said that she's not going, she doesn't have the same interest, let's say, or the same direction that Kitzhaber had. But what is her position now? And I guess also, what are some of the entanglements that Kitzhaber had that Kate Brown seems to be free of that might help her to make the right decision?
Governor Kitzhaber is clearly listening very closely to the LNG industry and to the building trades that wanted to build the Jordan Cove LNG terminal, and to companies like Northwest Natural Gas that had, at least during the LNG import phase, a big interest in seeing natural gas being branded as a clean type of fuel. And there's no mistaking the fact that Governor Kitzhaber viewed natural gas as a clean fuel, which is wrong, just flat out wrong. When it comes to carbon emissions, when it comes to greenhouse gas pollution, natural gas is on par with coal. Liquefied natural gas is arguably worse than coal.
And why is that?
Well, you have to take the stuff, super cool it, ship it across the world, regasify it, and then use it. So it adds a significant carbon penalty. And then the natural gas itself, all along the supply chain, is leaking. And methane is a very, very powerful greenhouse gas pollutant, much more powerful than CO2. And so as methane escapes from the supply chain, from natural gas production and transmission and ultimate end use, you know, that has this sort of disproportionately deleterious impact on the climate compared to CO2. And so it pushes the footprint of natural gas right up there with coal.
Because I think what confuses some people, I mean, natural gas appears to be cleaner when you burn natural gas. It doesn't have soot like coal or oil has.
That's right.
I know I've lived in houses, and mostly for the last long time, we've had natural gas furnace. But prior to that, I had an oil furnace. I remember when I was a kid going to grade school and we had a coal burner. It dates how old I was. And so it does appear to be cleaner when it burns. But I guess, first of all, I guess you have to distinguish between the particulate emissions, which is the what we used to think about mainly as our concern about pollution, and then the carbon emissions. So in terms of particulates, natural gas is clean burning fuel. Is that correct?
It is. But when you look at an LNG terminal and what's involved in an LNG terminal, it's far from clean. You're talking about the release of potentially toxic air pollutants. And with a liquefaction process, you have huge super tankers parked right next to some place like North Bend or right in the middle of Warrenton that burn bunker fuel, which is not natural gas and definitely spews out particulates and pretty nasty emissions in large amounts potentially. And so there is clearly an air impact. But yeah, what we're talking about when we're talking about natural gas is clean or not, it's been this idea that it's a climate solution. It's something that's better than coal in terms of the overall climate picture. And that's just not the case. And so I think we've made a compelling case to Governor Brown that that argument is not going to be acceptable to the people of Oregon. We're not going to view natural gas as a big improvement over coal. It's not factually correct. And so Governor Brown has said at this point she's officially neutral. She doesn't want to tip the scales for her agencies and how they're going to make decisions on this project.
Unlike Kitzhaber, which had both feet on the scale.
Well, Governor Kitzhaber clearly had stated, you know, where he thought things should end up with Jordan Cove, and that, you know, to their credit, many of the state agencies are doing a good job, you know, vetting the project. And so agencies like the Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ, have huge discretion over whether or not to approve the project. We're talking about one of the largest and most environmentally destructive projects in Oregon's history. At 5.67 million cubic yards of dredging and excavation in Coos Bay, 230 miles of pipeline, and then something roughly similar up in Warrenton, less dredging and excavation, but also hundreds of miles of pipeline going all the way up into Washington. These are agencies that can officially say no, and that's what happened with Bradwood. They said no to that clean water certification. They said, no, we can't certify that this project meets our clean water standards, and we don't think either Jordan Cove or the project in Warrenton, Oregon LNG, can possibly meet those standards if they are applied correctly.
Well, I found it disconcerting when I was following the debate, if it's a polite word, for what was going on around the Boardman terminal in Morrow. And I went to a hearing at the DEQ. And DEQ is basically saying at that time that when people raised all these climate change concerns about why this terminal shouldn't be permitted, and they would say, that's not our concern. Our concern only has to do with what kind of pollution is going to actually happen at that point. And I think the DEQ actually gave them the permit, as I recall, because they basically could not, didn't feel like they had the purview to take a stand on climate change, which I guess maybe their whole mission has to be restructured so that they can be a climate change permitting agency as opposed to just a particulate pollution agency. So I'm wondering, do you feel more optimistic that DEQ will have more teeth as far as actually ruling on LNG?
I feel like the Clean Water program and the water quality permit that's needed for Jordan Cove and for the Warrington proposal and Oregon LNG, both of those, it would take a Herculean effort to try to fit the sort of impact they're proposing into what we think the law says, which is you can't discharge a lot of pollution into rivers that are already impaired, for instance. Places like the Umpqua River that they would be cutting through with a pipeline, you know, just cutting through the river, you know, directly, not drilling underneath it, going right through the river. In other places, they would try to drill underneath, but plan B isn't good if the drill doesn't go well. And that applies for Oregon LNG as well, where they want to drill underneath the Columbia River from Columbia County all the way into Woodland, Washington.
It isn't that, like, that's miles and miles and miles of river at that point.
Yeah, it's a wide spot. It's not an easy idea to directionally drill across the Columbia River. But even if it goes well, you know, then the pipeline, you know, has to go through all these wetlands and streams, both in Oregon and Washington. And at least in Washington, Oregon LNG isn't proposing any compensatory mitigation for its project in Washington state for wetland damage. They're saying, well, we'll put things back right as we found them after building a 36-inch high-pressure non-odorized gas pipeline made of, you know, steel pipe.
That's kind of like putting back the mountains after mountaintop removal mining.
I'm sure it'll work out swimmingly.
Yeah, right.
But it's, you know, this is the sort of thing where, you know, I think we have a case to make that the state should say no. It shouldn't come to people having to go through 10 years more of dealing with potential eminent domain on their land or the destruction of salmon habitat that they worked hard to restore, or the, you know, shutting down of a fishery. You know, that none of that should be on the table. The answer is laid right in front of the state of Oregon now, that the way this happens functionally is, first things first, when FERC issues a permit for the Jordan Cove project, and they will, the federal government, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission will approve the Jordan Cove project. And when they do, we are calling on the state of Oregon to challenge that permit for two reasons. One, it oversteps the state authority, which the state hasn't made a decision yet, and so FERC shouldn't either. And secondly, it's wrong. FERC did a terrible job of assessing the climate change impacts of the Jordan Cove project. The Jordan Cove project would, by the time the coal plant shut down, be the largest greenhouse gas polluter in the state of Oregon. The Oregon LNG project would be close behind it because it's not currently explaining exactly where the power would come from, which is a big piece of that carbon impact. So, you know, essentially FERC is sidestepping not only the real climate change impact of the terminal itself, which they did a fairly poor job of assessing, but also the broader upstream and downstream climate impacts of all the methane that's leaking out and of this huge billion cubic feet of gas per day throughput of fracked natural gas that's going to be liquefied and shipped overseas if it were to go forward. And so the state of Oregon can stand up to FERC and say, no, we think that you need to do a better job assessing the impacts. And in the meantime, the state should just go ahead and deny the projects under its own authority.
Now, you're optimistic, it seems, about the state agencies doing what you hope they'll do and deny the project. What is your sense about Governor Brown? Do you think that do you have plans to continue to talk to her to see if she can move from neutral to a position that you find more favorable?
I think I'm optimistic that we have a compelling case, and we are very much in the fray with both the state agencies and Governor Brown. We are.
What do you mean by being in the fray?
I think we're at the critical decision point where we can't predict what they're going to do. It's very, very important for everyone who's listening to weigh in with the governor. And when the time comes with these key state agencies who have these permits to issue or not. And people are taking all kinds of creative actions to draw attention to this. There's a group called Hair on Fire that's hiking the pipe in Southern Oregon, which to me just sounds like 2 months of poison oak nonstop. But they're awesome. They're fired up and they're, you know, pulling together campaign to hike across most if not all of that pipe in Southern Oregon, which is a tactic that BARC used to draw attention to the Palomar pipeline when it was proposed for LNG import at Bradwood.
Less poison oak there, though.
Slightly less, yeah. And people are, you know, doing like what Jody McCaffrey is doing. She's drawing people together to challenge this worker camp that they have to build. To give you a sense for how big this LNG project would be, you know, they have to establish a new camp for thousands of workers in order to even consider constructing it. And so she and her group, Citizens Against LNG, and the folks down there have been challenging all of these local decisions that keep coming up. Heroically, they've been doing that for 10 years. And, you know, people all over, you know, the Columbia River, obviously, are standing up and saying, heck no, and they will be weighing in. And actually, today is a deadline for folks to weigh in with the state of Washington, which has its own permits to issue or not to issue. So what's different about, I think, LNG than a lot of the other projects is that there are a lot of moving pieces, and there are a lot of different places where a decision in the negative for the LNG developer could be a deal breaker. And that gives us many, many targets in terms of places we can organize and tactics we can use to get people inspired about this. And I think what's amazing to me is to see communities like Longview, Washington, where, you know, the pipeline for LNG would actually go right next to Longview. But they're also dealing with a potential oil refinery by a new company called Riverside, which is parent company is Waterside. And so they want to build this new oil refinery there. And then they're also dealing with this mega terminal for coal. And so these communities that are pulling together for one issue begin to get educated and networked in a way that allows them to resist on many fronts. And with amazing support from people in Portland and Salem and Eugene and all up and down the I-5 corridor, you know, we're standing firm right now, and we're holding the line, but we need people to remain and increase their engagement as the next months tick on here and we get closer to decisions on these big projects.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Sears, who is the conservation director for Columbia Riverkeeper, and we're talking about proposals to build mega export terminals for LNG, liquefied natural gas, and oil and coal here in the Pacific Northwest, and what communities are doing to try to keep that from happening. Well, in the remaining part of the show, let's go from liquefied natural gas to petroleum itself and talk about what's happening with the oil terminals. Interesting, another thing that happened while you're on vacation is that there was a gargantuan oil spill in Alberta. You heard about that one. Let's talk about that oil spill, because that's kind of like the kind of a crux of where this all, where a lot of this stuff is starting. Of course, well, some of the oil starts from Alberta, and others is fracked oil from the Bakken play in North Dakota. But what happened in Alberta, and how does that kind of, what picture does that paint for what we could see here if these proposals actually materialized?
I think the picture it paints is pretty alarming, and it should be alarming already. So the two proposals here in, you know, locally would be in Vancouver, Washington, where Tesoro proposes a 360,000 barrel per day oil terminal. That's massive. That's about 43% of the Keystone XL pipeline in one terminal. That would involve about 5 full mile-long unit trains of oil coming in each day. The second proposal is smaller, at 22,000 barrels a day initially. NuStar is proposing that, and there's a hearing on August 5th and 6th in Vancouver about that project. So Vancouver's looking at, you know, literally 5 to 6 full loaded oil trains per day rolling into town with these two projects. Those trains could be carrying either the type of oil that spilled in Alberta, tar sands oil, which is very heavy, very hard to clean up, and will even sink below booms once you try to clean it up. Let's say it were to spill into the Columbia River, not only would the river be moving it because it's a moving river, it would potentially sink under any booming, which is what happened in Michigan and the Kalamazoo River. Or it's carrying North Dakota Bakken crude, which blows up, you know, when it derails you know, there's this propensity for these, for the oil to actually ignite and explode. And we've seen that have catastrophic impacts. And we're not, we're about two years and 3 weeks after the terrible tragedy in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, where 47 people were killed when one of these trains exploded. That should have been a wake-up call. And we've seen over a dozen, 15, 20 other derailments
since then
of this Bakken crude, several of which have exploded, and others have caused not just explosions but big oil spills. So what that means for us is the Columbia River literally is facing, just an enormous threat of an oil spill from one of these trains. If one of these trains went off somewhere, it would be extremely difficult to clean up, to deal with, and the public safety impact would be enormous. Friends of the Columbia Gorge has been working with rural firefighters further up in Skamania County and other places to say, to come out and talk about, like, hey, we have these small rural fire protection districts that happen to be along these rail tracks that are carrying really explosive crude oil. The same is going for places, as far up the line as, Spokane, people are weighing in. The Washington State Firefighters Association has been vocally concerned and dealing with these oil trains. And so it's poison on both ends. You're dealing with the safety, the very catastrophic potential public safety and health risk of these oil trains, but also, what if that doesn't ignite? Well, then you've got an oil spill moving either in a tributary of the Columbia or the Columbia River itself. And right now, with the Columbia River being warm, with it being, in some areas, its tributary is obviously low in water, it's imagining an oil spill right now would be, even more catastrophic for the salmon who are trying to navigate this very stressed system. It's an injury we can't afford to gamble with. And the one thing I've said, people say, well, the trains are moving right now. They're going through Vancouver, Washington right now, and they're headed, to other refineries. And, I think I heard it from someone in Vancouver who said it, I think very in a pithy way. It said, it's like playing Russian roulette and loading more bullets in the gun, going from, one train a day to a guaranteed 5 to 6 going just to Vancouver. That's pretty alarming. So coming up, we expect to have hearings about all of these oil terminals. And what we're really trying to do is to bind together and stand in solidarity with the folks who are dealing with these projects further down the line. So the trains that would go, for instance, to Grays Harbor, Washington, there are 3 proposals in Grays Harbor, and 2 of them will have a draft environmental impact statement hearing likely in August. Those trains will also go down the Columbia River and will go through Vancouver. We don't expect them necessarily to come on the Oregon side, but if they follow the Union Pacific tracks, they could come through Oregon. They certainly will probably go on the Washington side. And so those hearings will be coming up in August. The smaller of the 2 Vancouver proposals has a hearing in August, in early August, that's that people can learn more about on our website. And then Tesoro, we expect to have the big draft environmental impact statement hearing in November or later, right around the same time as the Longview hearing for the coal proposal there. It's fairly dizzying, so I encourage folks to look at one of the kind of synopsis pieces about different fossil fuel projects in the Northwest. Sightline.org is a great source for all of that information. ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org has our newsletter up right now on our website, and the newsletter has a fossil fuel roundup. It looks at the projects in the Columbia River itself. And then I know Rising Tide did a map that shows sort of an interactive way on their website, different proposals all over the Northwest that are dealing with this, including the Jordan Cove project in Southern Oregon.
And on our website for Locus Focus, we have a link to Columbia River Keeper. So
great.
People can check out there and then go from there to the other places. And speaking of Sightline, next week we're going to have Eric DePlace on from Sightline to give us a Washington perspective. We'll mostly be talking about Shell and their invasion of the port of Seattle. But he's also quite a resource for just kind of understanding the whole energy landscape.
The one thing I would add about oil that makes it unique and a bit different than, when we talk about Governor Inslee being a decision maker on oil terminals, he is the decision maker. He's essentially the judge in the process in Washington. So when it comes to that Tesoro project and the decisions that the state of Washington has to make, everything is a recommendation up until it gets to him. And then he essentially says yes or no to whether or not Vancouver will be the location for the largest oil by rail terminal in North America. It's a jarring proposal, and it's one that you'd think that would be dismissed out of hand, but Tesoro is being very persistent in trying to bully the state into giving it what it wants.
Now, it seems like another end run around Tesoro shows up in this email that I mentioned from Stand Up to Oil, telling the Army Corps to deny Tesoro's Savage's dangerous oil terminal proposal. So how does the Army Corps of Engineers come into this, and what is it about this tactic that might be very effective?
Well, it was this sort of started as a kind of a no-brainer. It's like, well, you're going to build the largest oil by rail facility in North America, and no federal agency is going to do an environmental review of this, you know, despite the fact they would need to rebuild the dock and do all this in-water work. And so along with, you know, partners throughout the Northwest and Stand Up to Oil campaign, people did amazing work, and over 20,000 folks weighed in and said, Army Corps of Engineers, you need to take a look at this. You know, at a minimum, there's some environmental review that would be required for this type of project. And ultimately, they did agree, because people pressured the Corps directly, and people pressured their elected representatives to pressure the Corps for them. Both of those things were effective. And so the Army Corps of Engineers has decided to do some type of environmental review. They haven't said whether they'll do a full environmental impact statement yet. But that environmental review, they are taking comments on kind of what they should be considering until August 1st. And so we encourage folks to weigh in with the Army Corps. Now that they've decided to do something, we want them to do it well and to do it correctly. And I think it's interesting to look at the scope of what is proposed in Vancouver and to imagine the type of oil spills we've seen elsewhere. And, you know, the bar that these companies are trying to set is, we only want to look at the most narrow impact of these projects. We want to look at the impact of just dredging or drilling a little bit to make some pilings for the boat to tie to, and everything else we want to ignore as if everything's going to work perfectly. And what we need to do is to push back and say, we have example after example of catastrophic explosions and spills, and someone needs to look at this. And if you can't mitigate the impact, which you can't, then the project should not move forward. And the state of Washington has strong rules for that.
Well, the last thing I want to bring up again is that oil spill in Alberta. And I just wanted to ask you about how that the implications and the impact of that oil spill might have on changing minds. When I checked to see where it was, it's actually not very far from Edmonton, as it turns out. It's pretty far from Fort McMurray. So it's close to the most more densely populated part of Alberta. So more people are aware of it, I think, than maybe if it had happened further north. So do you think that spill is changing consciousness both up in Alberta and throughout the rest of North America?
I can't speak for Alberta, having not tracked their political processes closely. I know that they had an election that was essentially a rebuke of Stephen Harper. And
tar sands, actually.
And tar sands, yeah. Very directly. And that was interesting and a big shift for Alberta. At the same time, I think, you know, what it points to for us is that what we could be seeing is not just trains that blow up, but trains that spill in a way that is very, very difficult to clean up. So if you're thinking about bringing oil down the Columbia River, you have to pick your poison. Do you want the heavy tar sands, diluted bitumen that sinks, that could destroy salmon habitat for generations? Or do you want the light Bakken crude, which Tesoro referred to as mother's milk in one of the initial hearings? Mother's milk does not explode, last time I checked. And or do you want this Bakken crude that's very, very dangerous? And so that's, to me, what it says is we're looking at, you know, two very extreme risks in two very different ways. And all of it would be using the same basic infrastructure that's proposed to be built here. And so our task is to view the Columbia River as this sort of choke point for all of these fossil fuels and to choke it off and to say no. And we have the power to do that. I think Bill McKibben said it really well. I think it was two summers ago when he was here. He said, your geography is your destiny. You happen to be the shortest path between all of that dirty stuff and the markets that want to use it. And so use that power. And I think there are a million different ways to do that. And I really encourage people to get engaged in whatever way that they feel inspired to do so. If one of those is getting engaged with Columbia River Keeper and going to rallies and reaching out to people in the neighborhoods that are impacted by this, please do that. If it's something else, do that and do it too, you know.
And we'll have information about how you can do it on the website. And let's have you back again soon, Dan. So I think it's probably important to check in every couple months and see, because things are moving very quickly.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you that in the last 2 months since the rally that the LNG issue is over. But, you know, we're getting closer all the time, I think, you know, where I think what happened in Portland with the propane terminal with Pembina, which is, you know, something we're obviously all still watching very closely to make sure it doesn't come back. That was a really strong statement. And I think if we can do it here, if we can do it at Bradwood, if we can do it at Boardman with a coal plant or coal export proposal there, then we can do it in these other places as well.
Well, thanks a whole lot for joining us. It's been great talking to you again.
Thanks, Barbara.
We've been talking with Dan Searis, who's Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus, and we'll also have links to how you can get more involved in stopping the Northwest from becoming a major fossil fuel export center. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Ricky Lee Jones, who's going to be playing this week at the Aladdin Theater. So there's a little preview of her. Thanks for listening.
And good morning. It's just 15 seconds before 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. And coming up at 11, Ellen Goldsmith hosts Health Watch today, and her guest in the studio is Dr. Erin Lohman. At 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum, Roberta Hall's guests are Marge Stevens and Mike Bielstein, who helped Pastors for Peace deliver medical supplies to Cuba last summer. Thank you for listening to KBOO, and thanks, members, for your support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member.